If you're a startup founder not looking to spend a ton of time researching and managing vendors for your back office, check out Evry. Evry will get you incorporated completely free of charge and will then help with everything from banking, payroll, benefits, accounting, and taxes all in one seamless platform while keeping you compliant and saving you time. Evry.io not only takes ops off founders' plates, but guides founders with advice and concierge service along the way. Join over 1,000 startups who've simplified their operations with Evry. Get free incorporation and a $3,000 founder bonus when you deposit $500,000 or more, and 3% cash back on all card spend.
We're trying to give new and more creative financing opportunities to the people that are doing important things for our country. And it's in places that traditionally wouldn't get the attention. But the best statistic that we have in our book these days is the one that I'm most proud of, is that 75% of our borrowers more than double their top line government revenue while they're working with us. So they're actually using this to grow their business and become much more, not just stronger businesses, but much more capable providers to the government customer at the same time. Like, it's something where they're just in a much more stable position that allows them to be that much more effective. And I just think that's the best number we could be promoting.
Welcome to Austinpreneur, our show about the stories that made Austin, Texas, a global hub for startups. The show is produced by Capital Factory and hosted by me, Nick Spiller. As a reminder, by joining Capital Factory, you can plug into the ecosystem where the stories on the show were set. Learn more about us at capitalfactory.com.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back to the Austinpreneur podcast, where we discuss how Austin and the state of Texas became a global hub for technology, innovation, and venture capital. We're here recording live with the audience at Fed Supernova 2025. And we have a very special guest for today, James Parker, founding partner of Leonid Capital Partners. James studied here in Texas, a school called Rice, studied astrophysics, got an MBA at USC, started his career as a financial analyst, and then also spent time as an engineer at Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Lockheed Martin. Serves on multiple nonprofit boards as well as Special Operations Association of America, Veterans Education Project, Justice Solutions Group. And like I said, he's founding partner of Leonid Capital Partners, a private credit fund investing national security initiative. So let's join me in welcoming James to the show.
Thank you. I love a good audience clap.
Absolutely. It's the real thing, too. It's not AI. We got a real audience, real brains and atoms going on in the room. And I did use a little AI to prepare me, but that's all right. Let's dive in. Start with the basics. Give us an introduction of Leonid and the types of companies you back.
So at Leonid, we focus primarily on early stage companies that are working with U.S. government customers. You can think of us as an alternative to growth equity investing, focusing primarily on overweight national security, overweight small business, overweight contracts under $50 million. We give people an opportunity to leverage that a unique opportunity to leverage those forward cash flows off those government contracts to bring in capital in their business so they can invest and in growth in their business. So staff up a contract capture team, hire more engineers, buy a critical piece of equipment, something that makes their business stronger, helps drive up, either ensure the viability of their company more in the future, drive up their valuation, whatever their strategic objective is, but do it from a credit focus versus a straight equity.
Got it. And for those who may not be familiar, what do you mean by overweight?
That's our focus.
It's not a number.
Sorry. Yeah, our focus is that. Fortunately, we're not a bank, so we don't have a prescribed box that we have to be in, can be flexible. But the way our tastes run is we like people doing hard things. We like smart people doing hard things on important stuff, for lack of a better term.
And so for these companies working with DOD, other government partners, where give us more detail on where the debt solutions come in and you know, what they can unlock and the problems they solve.
So if you look at kind of the history of how people traditionally approach this, you would see what's normally called factoring, which is invoice, right. Invoice financing. It's, well, you have a live invoice, you sell it, and that way you can get paid on it early. For whatever, banks traditionally don't work certainly with earlier stage companies that have government contracts because of the government government cancellation right. I used to have to over-explain it 6 or 7 months ago, but now everyone's kind of aware of it. But like technically, a government contract can be canceled at any moment with 30 days notice and there's no penalty. So it's not a contract as you and I would ever really identify a contract, right? Banks look at that and say, I don't want to put 5-year money at risk against a 3-year contract. It could technically disprove tomorrow. So in the past, the only way anybody's ever been able to leverage their government work is through invoice factoring, which is, again, selling a live, valid invoice. And the reason why that's a good deal for the investor is that the government has never defaulted on a valid invoice in its history. The issue is that contrary to popular belief, the government's actually a very fast payer. Government book turns over every 37 days, which if you could get those terms in the real world, you'd take it all day long.
Right.
We have borrowers right now that they get paid in 3 days on contracts that are technically net 30. So the idea of clipping off the working capital solution, which is like kind of your money in motion, off a live invoice, if it only buys you maybe 14 days, even 37 days of working capital, it's not that impactful to you. We actually started out affected because it's a little intellectually lazy, but it's the only way anybody's ever done it before. What happened was that as a consequence of my partner and I's background, I was like, again, I was an engineer, my first iteration of my career, NASA and the intelligence community and whatnot. And then my partner is a PhD in neurobiology, and he was a DARPA-funded neuroscientist. We're scientists and engineers at our core. Those are the people we resonated with originally. So we ended up with a bunch of cyber clients in our factoring model. And what happened was it was a really interesting moment where our entire book came to us independent of each other and said, look, you're solving my 37-day working capital problem just fine, but I don't have a 37-day working capital problem. I'm not sweating payroll. Like, I'm a 10-man engineering shop. I'm trying to grow.
Right.
But I've tapped out my friends and family. There's not a meaningful equity market for what I do. I'm asset light because I'm all IP. And I took my one real asset, which is this contract, to the bank, and they laughed me out the door and said, it's not really an asset. But you guys seem to get this. Will you let us borrow against it? And rather than just saying no, because everyone's always said no before, we were just asked the question, recognize the government has the right to cancel this contract. How often do they actually cancel it? So we did my partner and I, it was the middle of COVID, so fortunately, like a little bit of a, everyone's sort of twiddling their thumbs in a little bit.
A little extra time on the internet, yeah.
We dumped 4 terabytes of public spending data, and we did a big data analysis on our own that effectively, said, if you focus in the right areas, the cancellation risk is minimal. And so you can then, we decided we could reasonably take that risk on, effectively forwarding some of those cash flows to give people that lubrication they need to build their business.
What are the right areas?
For us, it's, again, if we're lucky in the sense that if the government's ordered it, then we're okay with it.
Yeah.
Like, they've defined their need. They've decided you're the team to do it. Yeah. Like, they've done their TRL analysis. They've done their financial wherewithal analysis. So I don't get bogged down in technical validation. I don't get bogged down in whether or not you can, there's a commercial business to make. Like, I'm not a dual use investor in the sense that there has to be an obvious growth hook on the commercial side. We can move fast because as far as we're concerned, if the government has ordered it, then they've decided you're the right team to do it. And there's an interesting angle where the complexity of the work everyone is doing actually serves as a bit of security for us, because we get pushback every once in a while, which is like, well, isn't there execution risk? Like, what if they don't deliver? And the truth of the matter, in the size of the world we're working in and the type of work we're working in, if a team who is arguably the country's leading expert in that area, maybe the world's leading expert in that area, if they're having trouble with this very critical and very difficult task, if they run into trouble, program office is much more likely to give them a mod, more time, more money, or both, than they are to nuke the contract and then recompete the whole app. They talk to their boss's boss and explain why they're redoing it and they got it wrong, and then go back and try to reapportion more money and then find a new team to do it. But generally, they can't walk away from it because it's been identified as a strategic requirement.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it's a different perspective on
right.
that sort of thing.
And these critical areas and something that we need to push forward.
It's like we don't get to walk away from the AI risk or hypersonics or anything like that. You don't just get to decide it's not what we're going to do.
Right.
Because it's the cat's already out of the bag.
No more AI.
Yeah. We'll watch the wrong movie and then now AI at bat.
Yeah. So you started out factory and helping companies finance their working cash flow. You see this emergence of the cyber era. Mm-hmm. I see it's just all these, fascinating companies that we never met before really coming to us through the cyber opportunity. And you decided to look into it and are now providing debt financing mm-hmm. to actually help grow and unlock new milestones, not just help you,
solve not just make payroll.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. And so for companies in this segment selling to the government, what are some of the misconceptions around fundraising that you might be able to dispel for us?
Fundraising is tough in this space as much as there's a disconnect from multiple sides, right? So the government, for whatever reason, and it's changing ever so slightly because we're probably in the midst of the most financial conversion administration we've ever had. There's still a wild disconnect on what investors actually care about, right? And so you'll see things like, well, we're de-risking it because we're putting a bunch of money into it. Truth of the matter is, when it comes from the investor standpoint, everyone knows the government money can go away tomorrow.
Right.
So it doesn't truly de-risk it. That's why I kind of can't stand the idea where people keep on saying, they win a government contract and then we start talking about it. It's non-dilutive funding.
Mm-hmm.
It's not non-dilutive funding, it's sales. There's a cost structure associated. You're building a business, God forbid. You have a paying customer, right? But instead, in this world, we gin it up as trying to make it sound like it's somehow free money, and it's not, right? And from the operator side, when it comes to raising money, the government is still just it's not a desirable customer. I don't know why, but it's viewed as not a desirable customer. Probably because it can go away at any moment. It's slow, margins are limited. Mm-hmm. When you really think about venture investing requirements, the actual requirements of venture capital as an economic model, mm-hmm. it requires the ability to hit a 100 or 1,000x return to make the math work, period. And that is extremely limited in the government side of the world to hit those hooks, because you don't ever quite have that commercial uptick that you would get on most things, on most projects. And you just end up kind of fighting a weird dilution game, because in order to make the math work, they have to take an outsized chunk of your company every time. And then if you do are one of the few people that are lucky enough to get a real exit, the multiples are the lowest on record. You're stuck with industrials, get lumped in with Lockheed Martin. And so you never quite get that true ability to unlock the real valuation kick. A few people pulled it off, no doubt. But, one of the reasons why Palantir sells itself as an AI company, and it's really, at its core, more like a consulting company that has shitty margins. It's just terrible multiples.
An enigma.
Yeah. And then that's why everybody pushes their AI mesh networks and not their hardware, right? Which I get, but it's tough when you're starting out. Because you're gonna take a beating, because people are immediately going to lump you under the low ultimate return.
Stuff, but it feels like it's gotten a lot better. And here on the show, we've learned we've up until 5 years ago, there was really this cold period of working with the DOD in mm-hmm. particular, where the peace dividend, and we consolidated, but just, I guess, we market around when Army Futures Command was stood up, even DIU. There's focus in every member of the services come on the show. They focus on expanding the industrial base. Mm-hmm.
And that means just bringing a lot more companies, a lot more capacity, and growing that. And you're seeing, I think we're just in the early innings of it, but you're seeing a lot of companies, thousands of companies start to work that maybe never have before. And really this whole ecosystem we're emerged in is just around that.
100%. Like, it's great to see. It's become not just, like, we'll always go through weird hype cycles where it's cool to work with the DoD, but now it's even more so. It's people are starting to see it like it's a national imperative, which is super important.
Perhaps the only day.
Like, I agree. We've seen how exposed the supply chains get, and just how problematic. Like, as much as I understand the fundamental concept of globalization and why, like, if you bring people together and intertwine countries' futures with each other, it makes global conflict less likely. You're also assuming everybody thinks like us.
Yeah.
And they don't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we have a mandate where we have to come in and make sure we take care of the homeland. And I like to see the fact that this has become not just something that fringe technologists do. It's people that are the best at what they do are now moving into this market.
Yeah.
Like, it used to be that the smartest people in the world were putting people on the moon. And for a period of time, the smartest people in our country were trying to figure out how to sell more ads to people.
Right.
Like,
right.
I much prefer this set of the paradigm.
Absolutely. It makes my job more interesting. That's for sure. And so walk us through your financing structure a little more in depth. Like, how does setting up a line of credit or term loan work? And you'll look for group working with the contractor.
We pride ourselves on having a really streamlined product, like, or process, I should say. There is no reason why we can't get the money out the door inside of 30 days from an initial conversation. So that in and of itself, that is
pretty quick.
Yeah. That's, three times faster than your average bank, if they would even talk to you. We've done deals as quick as 7 days. We have a program called Lightspeed. We'll do money out the door in 10 days, like limited underwriting. It's limited risk. It's like, we don't take red lines, but like, we can get this stuff done fast if people need it. Primary requirement on our end is, like, you're working on a contract, some sort of government contract. Can be a prime, can be a sub. Like, we can work with that. We will generally, if after the introductory call, we'll come in, we'll set up a data room. We give you our docs up front, like, so everyone knows what they're getting into. I cannot stand it. We founded this thing with this idea that everybody we work with is a scientist and engineer. They're going to do an algorithm to figure out what they'll do the math to figure out what their real cost of capital is. So why are we hiding it? Mm. Like, there is no raft of extra fees. We don't have sort of this a teaser rate and then a bunch of gotcha stuff at the end of the day. It's a what you see is what you get environment. We don't ask for personal guarantees because most of the people we're working with, their main asset is this company. Anybody who actually is worth getting a personal guarantee from will never give it to you. So, like, why am I going to put somebody in a position where they've got to go home and explain to their family why they put the, put the house in hock, like, over this one more thing, just one more time. So we try to take all that friction off. I would say it's a fairly reasonable but light touch as far as underwriting. Get through work. You have a couple passes, questions, understanding the business model a bit. Again, not diving into your source code. Like, I'm not trying to determine whether or not you're the right guy to do this counter UAS system. The government's ordered it. They've already decided that for us. So it's more about us understanding the deliveries and the requirements of the contract, and then how that matches up with the realities of your business. Cool. Like, our ideal client is somebody that, if they want a contract, they're sitting on a contract. If we weren't there, they'd still get through the other side. What they really want to do is use that and leverage it to grow their business. They're not looking for, like, completion financing. They got into they overpromised, and they're not set up to deliver on the contracts. It's kind of an interesting box because everyone sort of assumes, like, we're there to help you finish the contract. Our goal is, like, you should never, if you keep racking government contracts, you should never have to raise equity capital again. Because you can always come back to us, borrow. Yes, you're going to pay an interest rate, but you're going to keep as much equity in your hands as possible for as long as humanly possible.
And are the companies typically have some equity investors, or I guess where is the role for?
It runs the gambit, right? Like, we've got some that are full on mom and pop shops that have just built up a solid DLA supplier for the last 20 years. Yeah. I've got super, you know, people that have raised $300-400 million of equity capital. It runs the gambit. Yeah. Usually our typical borrower has probably got mainly friends and family in, and then one or two organized venture groups. That's not a requirement for us, though. We're not venture debt. Yeah. That's one of the big misconceptions. They'll come to us and say, you're loaning to early stage companies, you're venture debt. And that's not how venture debt actually works, right?
Government.
And, yeah. We're senior secured loan. It's a corporate loan. Your company is borrowing money. We just happen to size and structure our facilities with you based on your government work.
Are you familiar with, collaborated with the Office of Strategic Capital, their credit program?
We have. We are pretty tight with them in general. We're not in the program. That's an interesting, it's a sticky wicket on that one. It's interesting. Their main pushback on our model, because full disclosure, we applied for the SBIC license and it was all green lights until all of a sudden out of nowhere it was no. But the feedback largely was, well, you already work with defense companies. And our mandate is to bring companies into the defense industrial base, not work with companies that are currently in it. It's an OMB thing. There's a circularity. They don't like the idea of taking government money and loaning money that gets repaid back with government money. I'm not going to judge, at least not here. But at the end of the day, we have a very good relationship in the sense that we have a very similar mindset. We're trying to give new and more creative financing opportunities to the people that are doing important things for our country. And in some places that traditionally wouldn't get the attention.
Y'all will have a chance to ask questions in a minute, so think of any. But yeah, how do you size your investments? Is there a certain...
We have done revolvers as low as $300,000, and we've written $30 million loans. Yeah. Our average ticket size, call it $5 to $10 million dollars. I will always do the small stuff, people working on their first SIBR, because it serves as great feedstock for the rest of my business. I like the idea of encouraging people to keep doing this sort of work. And if they have an exceptional outcome with, using our product to help grow their business, they're much more likely to come back. I think at this point, the last time I checked, a touch over 45% of our book was repeat business, people that just win a new contract. The way we structure our facilities, it's really easy to expand right away. Win a new contract, we can expand availability and either and just adjust the math based on how on repayment or provide more capital. And it's really easy for us to flex and expand in that way. But the best statistic that we have in our book these days is the one that I'm most proud of, is that 75% of our borrowers more than double their top line government revenue while they're working with us. So they're actually using this to grow their business and become much more, not just stronger businesses, but much more capable providers to the government customer at the same time. It's something where they're just in a much more stable position that allows them to be that much more effective. And I just think that's the best number we can be promoting.
Help them perform.
Right. Do the right thing. Do the hard stuff for the right people.
Talked about term loans, revolving lines of credit. I think you also view acquisition financing. When does that make sense?
There's an interesting angle here, right? Because especially as we're starting to see consolidation, particularly in kind of the small space area, there's a lot of mergers happening. One of the things people can do is they can take their existing contract stack, they can take the target's contract stack, and then we can provide an ability to help finance potentially that acquisition. Now, you're going to have to find a way to pay for it as that money comes in. It needs to go to debt service, obviously. Mm-hmm. But if there's a transaction you can take advantage of, and then maybe worry about backfilling some of the load on that afterwards, this is a pretty good opportunity for you to actually create some strategic capability.
What are some red flags that you see sometimes when you're evaluating companies and
without poking the bear on my VC brethren, but it's the hyper growth at all costs. It's creating an expense structure that doesn't reasonably match your business model or your prospects, right? Almost all of our companies are cash flow negative. Everyone's in growth mode. We're perfectly comfortable there. But when you are in the, you know, for lack of a better term, capital incineration mode, because you think that the next raise is inevitable, that's usually where people get into trouble. Like, just not just with us, but just holistically. Yeah. It makes me itchy.
So you're after zebras, not unicorns.
I want people that understand their business, that have the eye on trying to grow, that understand the value of their equity, and they're willing to take a risk, and they're willing to take on a liability in the form of debt. Yeah. But like, it's because they're betting on themselves, right, not necessarily on the hype cycle solving the problem.
Okay. And then, how do you see the financing landscape evolve in the next 5 to 10 years for in this area of national security and government contracting?
We have a thing, it's funny, we just started our DC. We realized we didn't have enough of a ground game in DC,
right,
which, like, we're in Huntington Beach, we're in Orange County, it's great, but we're effectively in the hinterlands, like, when it comes to a lot of this. So we opened up a DC office. Our man Sam is moving in there and is going and hanging up a shingle at Station DC and
Sweet.
Doing that. But as part of that, my partner Chris and I went out to the Hill and, like, we're like, let's just try to figure out how this works. I grew up out in the suburbs of D.C. I know enough to be dangerous, but I'm definitely not a creature of the Hill. Mm-hmm. But you get a lot of people coming after you. Like, you got to get a lobbyist. You got to get a lobbyist. And I was like, the one problem with getting a lobbyist right now in our situation is the one thing I know that guy's going to do is tell me he's doing a great job. Like, and I'm going to have no idea if it's good or bad, like, whatever. So we have to try to do it ourselves to learn a little bit. Mm. And so we just went out and, like, basically found anybody on the Armed Services Appropriation Committee, anybody where we had an investment in their area, and, like, tried to book a meeting and had decent success. Again, you're not sitting down with, you're not sitting down with the senator or the congressman themselves. Nobody ever gets that meeting, at least not. But you're talking to national security advisors, small business advisors. And the big thing for us is we realized also coming in, like, we don't actually have an ask. Like, I don't need a line item in the budget. It doesn't help me. Like, I don't need a law changed. Everything I do is fine. Like, but we need something to talk about. And the thing I really hung on, and this kind of speaks to your actual question, I'm sorry, I'm a little is that there's a lot of talk in this space of how do we encourage more private capital into national security concerns, like, areas of national concern. Mm-hmm. And heretofore, the government's approach has been like, well, we'll stand up OSC. We'll de-risk it by putting government money up front. Mm-hmm. The problem is, it's not really speaking to the needs, the actual incentives of an actual investor base. Because they're like, okay, great, you put some money up, but you can take it away. And once the next guy's in charge, or once the midterm elections happen, is that really going to come? Mm-hmm. It doesn't really meet the need. And it's like, this is like full Daniel Kahneman stuff, right? It's like, show me the incentives, I'll show you the behavior, right? And they care about returns. Patriotism will break a tie. But absent of that, no one's going to make an investment in a space if their expected returns aren't higher than another alternative. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a whole horde of financial advisors, RIAs, they're obligated as a fiduciary to maximize their returns. They can't even make the choice to put something into a lower returning vehicle. Yeah. So our hook on it was like, take something that exists out in the world, tax credits, preferential tax treatment for QSBS, tax credits like green energy tax credits. Why aren't those applied to national security investments? Mm. If this is important, if we need critical minerals mining, if we need people working on hypersonics, if we need all this stuff, and like, why aren't we making it so that we can, we can't tell the market to value it more. We don't get to instruct the market to increase the exit multiples. I read an article that says we need the market to increase the multiples. I was like, great.
Please.
Yeah, I'd love that. But really, at the end of the day, you need to find, like, you have, people need to understand that with the LP, certainly our LP base, like, and pretty much any professional base, every basis point matters. Anything you can do. Tax treatment on capital gains tax, we're a credit investment, so our returns are ordinary income taxed. Yeah. They don't even get capital gains tax treatment. So that, like, despite what our headline might be, like, our investors get a certain amount. And they're like, it would be a lot better if I could write off your management fees. It'd be a lot better if I could get taxed as a capital gains tax. Yeah. Maybe just a, like the QSBS, a capital gains tax holiday on stuff. Yeah. frankly, if this goes through, it's going to help everybody else probably more than my firm, but like it would be important for the country. Mm-hmm. Like, why would, like, we do this all the time. Like, everybody drives a Tesla because there's a $7,500 tax credit on it. Like, why aren't we giving people the opportunity to invest in something that is critically important to our nation and our nation's security and giving them a preferential benefit for it? Yeah, it's not free, but at least the American taxpayer is paying for it after the investment's been made and there's been some sort of result, as opposed to trying to front run it with scout offices and seed checks and like kind of all this stuff that has kind of a dubious track record of success.
Tell us about that, the dubious track record of success.
It's not that anybody's like, the government is not like, again, we're kind of in an era now where the government is probably the most financially conversant it's ever been. But if you walk up to your average person, the government right now, and said, can a company borrow against their government contract? They'd be like, sure. It's, they've got the full faith and credit of the federal government. It's the best customer in the world. It's the largest customer in the world. And that's just wrong. Like that fundamentally is wrong. There's just a disconnect of how the world actually looks at these sorts of things. And then there's some stuff that looks and feels smart. Like if we invest money, we show people we're invested in it, they'll come along and view it. Again, this goes back to like the non-dilutive funding. We gave them a contract and then we called it non-dilutive funding. So it's work, like right. Sales. But right. Instead, like people see through that. Is the thing. Like, that money can go away. We all know how the budget, everyone's been through, I don't know how many budget cycles, how many government shutdowns, how many continuing resolutions. The government's not reliable in that sense of like holding up its end of that bargain. I commit to opening. How many reboots has DIU been through?
Three.
Like, yeah. So like, and I love it. And I love the work they're doing, but like the amount of effort people put into it and then it gets restarted constantly. Mm-hmm. People are cotton to that. They picked up on it. So the way
I would say in DIU's defense, every time they restart, it gets 10 times bigger.
I totally agree. Like, but at the same time, from an investor, from your average person who's trying to get an exposure to mm-hmm. it,
yeah,
it looks unpredictable.
Right.
And when you're trying to make an investment decision versus this or that, yeah. You're going to go for something that's much more stable and much more predictable every time. Right. Which is sad because the government should be the bedrock. Like, this should be the most predictable thing mm-hmm. you can have. Mm-hmm. And it's just not viewed that way, rightly or wrongly. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Perception is reality, right? But that is the viewpoint on the world.
Very interesting. Thank you very much for that. Anyone in the audience have a question for James? Well, Sam, then Eric.
You know, what is the value of the contract that you loan on, 100% or some percentage of it?
We go, what we do is we advance somewhere between 50 and 75% of whatever's left on the contract, right? So you can come in midstream, like we'll look at the remaining value on your CLINs, and we'll put somewhere between 50 and 70%, 75% upfront, and then you pay us back as you execute on the rest of that contract.
Follow-up question. So, typically, you said there are a lot of like SBR type of, you know, small companies, and they advance the funds, and they're typically looking for the SBIR when I've come to. What's that risk of them? They're not always going to get those SBIRs coming to them.
The way we structure our facilities is that you pay us back on our loans as you're executing on the particular contracts you're currently working on. So it also allows me to get into these deals faster in the sense that I'm not actually trying to make an assessment of whether or not you're going to win three or four more contracts. Like Maya is, if you're on contract, I am ultimately, if it's a type of contract I like, I'm ultimately confident you're going to get through the other side of it and then the government's going to pay. So we help you pull that money in early so you can make an investment now versus wait till the payment cycle. We wait for the execution and payment cycle to work its way through. And then if you win another contract, you can come back and say, here's, I won another one. And then we can rejigger the math either on repayment schedule and extend it or increase your advance amount because you've got new award value for us to sort of run our math on.
Question? Hi, I live in DC as well. And there's a lot of structures by the World Bank and the American Development Bank, particular guarantees. Mm-hmm. And there was a vehicle in which they took like a grant and they used that as a guarantee for a series of credits. So it's mm-hmm. kind of like a portfolio guarantee. And the idea was that you know, you have the expectation of if a loan goes into default, there's the loss given default and the probability of default. So what the guarantee did is actually just kind of guaranteeing the expected loss.
Right.
And if you do it as a portfolio, it has a multiplicative effect. Have you guys thought about an idea like that with a guarantee on the back for the private sector?
We haven't. Like, we're trying very, like all of you, we started this business ourselves, right? And like, one of the things I think people get trapped on is trying to do too much too fast in too many different ways. And so this is our world, and we're trying to do this as well as we can. I'm sure there's any number of potential solutions people could come up with to address this in a variety of ways. But that's not part of our wheelhouse. I try not to be what we're not. Like, my big thing, people often call us, this is a little bit of a disconnect, but we'll say, well, are you going to help me get another contract? And I think there's a lot of people in this space that will present themselves as the secret to unlocking more business. That's not us. It's just not what we do. Like, what we do is help you access the capital you need to grow your business your way, and you get to stay in control of it without trying to dictate your world. So again, it's a little bit of a diversion from your question, but it's not what we do. So I can't comment on it. I wish I could, make me sound smarter.
For the payback to you, do they go to you directly or they go to back to the cover?
We set up a cash control system. So per the FAR, right, the money has to go to an account in your name, right? So what we do is we set up, we ask you to open up an account at our bank. We put what's called a deposit account control agreement or a DACA on top of it, makes it a lockbox. And we'll point your SAM account to that account. When that money comes in, that's how we do the debt service. One of the real advantages of what we do is that you only make your payments when you get paid by the government, right? It's not, we have multiple structures if you prefer to do it a different way, but the way we launched this business was that understanding that things can happen. Payment delays happen, your TPOC goes on TEY, whatever happens, you know, you need to resubmit and your CLIN's 3 or 4 days, you know, 3 or 4 months late, whatever. We didn't want anybody sitting there sweating, making like a mortgage payment, right? Like, so what we did was set up this system where we feel confident because we know we're going to see the cash flows into that account that we control, but then you're only really making your P&I payments, your principal and interest payments, when you actually get paid. So we take that sort of timing delay risk with you. And what we'll do is we'll take the due payment, we'll run the math, take the due payment there, and then we'll send any residual balance back to you. And if there's other money that comes into that account, because it is SAM and all the government money, if your tax return comes in there, we just pass that through without friction. Like, at the end of the day, it becomes a daily process of us of just moving the money back into your accounts, into your operating account. I mean, like, Stan, like, there's like a $50 fee on the bank account. Like, and there's wire fees, like, kind of standard, but I think our wire fees are $35-$40, something like that. Like, very, very clearly our world, we decided to design it without the weird litany and schedule of excess fees. Is generally, you're going to look at it, you know exactly what you're going to pay. I mean, like I said, in our process, we'll send you our deal docs up front, so you know exactly what you're signing up for. It's not like you get excited about doing it and then all of a sudden you're going to be surprised by a bunch of terms at the last minute when you're really counting on the money. We'll actually even send you, based on your specific contract, what we call our flow of funds, so you can see exactly how the loan will behave before you ever get into the diligence process. There's no resource more valuable than time. And like, again, we're entrepreneurs ourselves. This is not something that's going to work for me. Everyone deserves to know that up front. And they deserve to know what they're getting into.
Chime in, thanking James for coming on the Entrepreneur Podcast.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Austinpreneur. Don't forget to check out capitalfactory.com to learn more about us and join our community. If you have thoughts about the show or ideas on how we can work together, reach out to me directly via email, Nick Spiller @capitalfactory.com. Shout out to the Capital Factory Dream Team for making this podcast possible, and special thanks to Aaron Handworker, who masterfully recorded and edited the show. Come back next week for a whole new episode.